This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 255 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. If you've been listening to the show, you've heard us talk about Framebridge before. They make it super easy and affordable to frame your favorite things, from art prints and posters to the travel photos, speaking of Potterod, sitting on your phone. Here's how it works. Just go to framebridge.com and upload your photo. Or they'll send you packaging to safely mail in your physical pieces.
So you can preview your item online in any frame style, choose from your favorites, or if you feel like you'd rather have an expert eye, they have free recommendations from their talented designers. The expert team at Framebridge will custom frame your item and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang.
Instead of the hundreds you'd pay at a framing store, their prices all start at $39, and all shipping is free. That alone is huge. Plus, our listeners will get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use our code Outlander. So Summer, let's chat briefly about the beautiful pictures we've gotten framed by Framebridge.
Well, I'm sure I shared this before, but the picture that I put on Framebridge was of my Highland coos from our trip. This farmer, Neil, let us take pictures and hang out with his cows. I snapped a few photos, and one of them I loved so much that this was the perfect thing. So now I have a gigantic picture of Highland coos that is going to be on my wall soon.
Yes. And then what Summer and I did, because it was just in time for Father's Day, and we'd actually missed Mother's Day while we were in Scotland, was Summer and I try, whenever we're in Scotland together, to get at least a few pictures of us, selfies of us in one frame. And when we found one, we're like, yeah, let's do it. So we had a Framebridge blow up a picture of us and give to our parents for Father's Day belated Mother's Day. So we love Framebridge.
So get started today. Frame your photos or send the perfect gift for weddings, birthdays, and special events. Go to framebridge.com and use promo code Outlander, and you'll save an additional 15% off your first order.
Just go to framebridge.com using promo code Outlander. That's framebridge.com, promo code Outlander. Now, Summer, do we have any announcements this week? I think we may have one or two, kind of.
Pod Abroad is open.
Oh my goodness, I wasn't even thinking about that, but yeah, hello.
Get ready to be sick of us talking about Pod Abroad.
It's like our summer soft sponsor. Right. And the sooner we fill up, the sooner we'll shut up.
That is true.
Yeah. So we have planned and booked and everything for Pod Abroad 2019. And if you're interested in finding out about something from 2018, then you can go to Instagram or Twitter and search the hashtag, all one word, Pod Abroad 2018, Pod Abroad 2018. And you'll see not only what we've shared on the podcast account, but also what we've shared personally and what all or many of our alumni, our Voyagers who are now alumni, shared and still share even now, you know, looking back, like Throwback Thursday or whatever it may be. So you'll find a lot of shots if you want to see some of the things that we saw or did.
Knock on wood, you can't ever guarantee, but I had faith that we were going to have a great time. Number one, it's in Scotland. Number two, you're seeing beautiful places. I guess that's all included in the word Scotland. But we're seeing these places that inspired some of our favorite books that are very important in history. And when you meet other fans who love the series just as much as you do, obviously the books is most, if not all of the people, maybe not the husbands, had read the book. So these were not only series fans, but of course, book fans. You don't have to have read the books. There's no quiz. You can join us no matter, even if you have not watched Outlander, but you love Scotland. It is definitely an Outlander-inspired tour.
And I think you'll get a lot out of it. But we've had the question before, well, what about if I bring my husband or if I bring a girlfriend, you know, and she's not read or he's not seen the books or the TV show? If you've read the books and or seen the TV show, you absolutely will fall in love all over again. We guarantee it. There's no way for you not to love this trip. But if you haven't seen it, or if you're worried that your significant other would be bored or, you know, just not be in it because it's kind of a girl's thing, you get out of it what you put into it. And by that, I mean, if you have the right attitude, which everyone did, I mean, everyone was just like super blown away with the absolute raw gorgeousness of Scotland. It's just, I mean, it's freaking magical. I just can't say it enough. And I said it a million times, but if you have not read the books or seen the series, you will love it just as much. Yes, of course, it's Outlander inspired. But Outlander, if you know anything about our show is pretty much Outlander inspired. It's like 95% books and show. But we have interviews with historians and First Nations people. But all of the central thing that tie these together is Outlander and Scotland. So if you're a fan of the books or series, of course you're going to love it. Just go look at the itinerary. You will love it. But if you're not, or if you haven't read or seen the show, you will still love it because of the beauty, because of the history. We get a private tour. Like, I'm telling you, this is bespoke of the bespoke of a quite intimate tour on a coach. You're taken everywhere, and we'll describe more stuff. Summer and I are going to do some Q&As, but you will get mention and you'll see pictures. We share things from Outlander, of course, but our tour guide, Susan Brown, is stellar. She knows the history like the back of her hand, and she will describe, as we're driving up the motorway, she will describe what happened in, oh, that little ruin over there, or oh, those barracks over there. And it may have a Jacobite relationship. It may not. It may not have an Outlander link. And, you know, really, honestly, who cares? Because there's so much Outlander on the trip that you will, your cup will runneth over. But even if you're not into Outlander, it's so, you will love it.
She is a Blue Badge tour guide first. No mistaking it. But she has read all the books. So it's like, she's also an Outlander fan. So I think she really is the best of all the possible things that you could hope for when booking this type of a tour.
So we will keep it brief. We've waxed poetic here, and we will wax poetic, maybe not as long each episode, but we will definitely bring that in each episode to make sure we spread the word far and wide. And as I hinted at or said earlier, Summer and I do something a little different this year. What we will be doing is several Q&As. So we will be talking a little bit about this year's trip and answering your questions that you might have about the trip. And so we'll try and do those on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter. So we will vary our locations. And so you guys have a chance to see us if you're not on different platforms or if you are on only one platform. So we'll announce those with at least a day or two notice. We look forward to that, to meeting you guys and seeing you guys on those lives. And of course, we'll keep them so you can go back and view them at your leisure. And finally, we need to share the link. Summer, where do they go to find all about Pod Abroad 2019?
That would be www.podabroad.com. And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be beginning part 9 of Drums of Autumn.
Passionnément.
That's it. And chapter 40, entitled Virgin Sacrifice. Sit tight, people. This is a long chapter.
We're back with Bree. Lizzie Weems, Bree's bondservant, is sick. She's now had 3 bouts of some sort of illness. Now, this latest, they had been traveling on horseback, and she gets sick, and they have to stop to make camp. Bree dribbling water down Lizzie's throat and all over her to cool her down. Now, to get this water, she's going back and forth in the dark through the night to a creek. Diana writes, quote,
She wasn't afraid of dark woods or lurking animals, but the thought of Lizzie dying in the wilderness was terrifying enough to make her want to head straight back to Charleston, unquote. I know Diana wasn't likely meaning to emphasize this point, but this not being afraid of dark woods or lurking animals, this is definitely a Bree thing. A 20th century, maybe not all women, but definitely 20th century woman thing, but more so a Bree thing. The next morning, they're able to ride again. Now she really must find Claire. Bree also now begins to appreciate her own size. So how does she really feel about 18th century colonial America? Quote, the longer she spent in this miserable place, the more advantageous they seemed. That would be her size, etc. With the fevers, chills, etc., Bree is convinced that Lizzie has malaria. They'd been plagued by mosquitoes since their ship got close to land and then spent 3 weeks, quote, meandering through the shallow coastal waters to Charleston, unquote. Dude, I got a tear prick when Bree has a moment of her mom speaking through her. Not like voodoo yet, but when she says something to Lizzie as she's caring for her, and then she like realizes like it's her, this is what her mom would do. As she's caring for Lizzie, she's thinking of her mom caring for her. And as she got a little bit emotional, I got a little bit of a tear prick there.
Well, I just felt like she's lucky her mom was who she was, or she wouldn't have known what was wrong with Lizzie or how to even remotely begin to fix it.
Or that it was so important. Well, I guess you don't have to know what the thing is or might be to know that she's sick. Anyone can tell she's sick. But yeah, she wouldn't have known a potential diagnosis, certainly. Lorraine B. writes, Brianna may not have any children of her own yet, but here we see how wonderful a mother she could be. Lizzie's malaria is unforgiving in the same way a child's sickness is. Brianna keeps up her vigilance in dealing with the chills and fevers as best she can, and we find out what she didn't bring the stones. Aspirin. But what she did bring through is compassion learned from her mother. Martina P. writes, it's endearing how well Brianna cares for Lizzie's health and is so patient with her. She certainly is her mother's daughter. I can't help but feel nervous that Lizzie's sickness will interfere with getting to the destination in a timely manner. So when they'd arrived at their accommodations, the landlady had called an apothecary after looking at Lizzie. She left the room, Bree did, when Lizzie was being examined by the apothecary, but she'd come back in right away when she heard Lizzie cry out. The man was bleeding her, and of course by that we mean where you'd make a cut in the crook of the elbow or somewhere on the forearm and allow a certain amount of blood to come out to supposedly cleanse the humors. And so Bree understandably flies off the handle and kicks him out. Now he'd said she'd had an ague and the landlady called it seasoning. So the process of seasoning new immigrants getting used to all the area bugs and germs. So, I mean, I don't think there is getting used to malaria. It's not a cold. Bree is exhausted and it is hot and muggy. Bugs are biting her too. But she, like Claire, notes, quote, the bugs were not nearly as fond of her as they were of Lizzie, unquote.
I think they're at least twice as much interested in Brianna than they are in Claire.
Because
she's half from that time period.
I see. Yeah, that's maybe. Yeah. The only thing to do was to find Claire as quickly as possible. Now Bree's planning on selling her horses and getting a boat to Cross Creek to find her Aunt Jocasta. She has thoughts of Roger, but not yet. So Lizzie's fever broke the next morning. Now, again, she's had it like 3 times now, so she could get sick tomorrow or 2 days from now, whatever. Bree pays the landlady to watch Lizzie while she goes out to sell the horses. That night, Lizzie was downstairs, obviously feeling better. And she's done their laundry. Now, this sets us up for a little later. Obviously, Lizzie, when she was purchased, when her contract was purchased, when Bree bought her contract, or when it was bought for her, she became her indentured servant, right? Her bondswoman. And as such, when she's not sick, she does chores. She does duties. She waits on Brianna or does, you know, assist her in some way. And when she's not sick, when she's sick, she can't do it. But when she's not sick, she does things like probably help clean up her meal, does her laundry, et cetera. This may have been understood. It may not have been understood. But the reason I think, and this is not important, I don't think, to the story, but it's just maybe helpful, is the reason it's important is because it sets us up as readers, knowing that, okay, her servant is doing her laundry. So she knows what her clothing looks like. That's all I'll say right now. She knows the state of Bree's clothing, mud stains and all. And then I haven't said it yet. I haven't, even though it's been in the chapter thus far. It's like Bree and britches. No one seems, I mean, I'm sure the guys like it, but they're still shocked. The women, like, no one is approving of her in britches. And when Lizzie mentions meeting your da, kind of like in a shocked way, like, you're wearing britches and I cannot imagine you doing this when you're meeting your da. And Bree freaks out. Yep. Lizzie found out that a gentleman had heard of James Fraser and was well acquainted with him. The man's name was Andrew McNeil, and he also knew her Aunt Jocasta. She even mentions Claire. So the man knew she was a great healer. This McNeil had seen Claire do the ball surgery on our favorite backwoodsman. What was his name again?
Myers.
John Quincy Myers?
Yep.
James Fraser in Cross Creek. He's going to stand for someone at a trial, which will be just over a week away. So now Brianna has a place, so like thereabouts, and she has a date. So she knows how long she has to get to a certain spot. Lorraine B. writes, I love the way Lizzie's character starts to come out. She's so shy when we first meet her. And now we hear that she's chatted up a tavern patron who has just shared the info we want. When I first read the chapter many years ago, I didn't know how or where Brianna might meet her parents. Diana made it unexpected and thoroughly entertaining, starting with Lizzie's wild description of Claire's surgery on Mountain Man Myers. Christine O. writes, it is so classic Claire when Brianna knows for certain that she has positively and without a doubt found her mother after Lizzie relays Mr. McNeil's story. Quote, he had seen her do a desperate operation on a man, laid him smack in the middle of the dinner table, and cut off his bollocks and then stitched them back on. Right there in the spot, we all the dinner party looking on.
Such a game of telephone. We all know that's not what happened, by the time it traveled around the city and made it back to somebody else,
he had three balls, somebody that knew those people. Got another one.
Exactly. Though I'm sure that's exactly what it looked like to an onlooker.
Yeah, that's true. Scene change. We go to Roger. Roger is in Wilmington. Oh my gosh. The Gloriana arrived only 10 days after the Philip Alonso. I mean, this is like, maybe not grande, but because it was planned, but really, really like it's close. Lorraine B. writes, so how many of you flashed on a shipwrecked Claire in the water when Roger clings to the fact that he somehow knows that Brianna is also in Wilmington, like a drowning sailor clinging to a spar?
Can we enter this as the grande of the chapter?
Of him arriving?
No, but them finding each other.
Oh, heck.
At all.
Heck. That's the grande of the book.
Right? I'm like, because yes, he saw the ship's manifest of where she was going, but the idea that he could just take a boat from Scotland to the New World and just magically enter upon
and get a job.
The pub where she happened to be on the day. I'm like, to me, that was just like a really grande.
So Roger had helped unload the Gloriana and then he peaced out. He got instead of turning right, he turned left. He literally just went the other way. So he got a job on another ship and then left that. He's going tavern by tavern looking for her. Now, someone in his fifth tavern says he'd seen her. And then before dark, he covers five more. Quote, he discovered the tall, redheaded girl in men's clothing had been causing public comment for nearly a week. Unquote. He tries a tavern called the Blue Bowl, and she's there. He sees her.
He enters and slams the door behind him. She turns, sees him, and then goes through many emotions, from startled, recognition, joy. She's smiling and says, "Oh, it's you." And then she screams, full on scream, like horror. And he grabs her. Quote, "Her face had gone dead white, her eyes round and dark with shock." Unquote. He wants to take her outside, but people are standing up for her and saying that she says it's all right, and people are, you know, getting afraid for her safety. And she tells Lizzie, "It's all right, go to bed, I'll be up later." And then she goes outside. Roger
falls. I mean, he's kind of menacing.
Oh, dude. He's kind of a lot menacing.
I'm just saying, if I would like to think that if that happened in a bar today, where some dude showed up and just grabbed a chick and was trying to drag her out of the bar, clearly against her will, that people would stop it.
Yes. So we're going to talk about it, obviously, because it happened. There's a conversation about it. A lot happens in this chapter. But I don't think it's not jumping the gun. But I have to say, the first time I read this book, I mean, I don't even know how many years, I think I read it in 99 as well. I read everything I could in 99 because I think that's all that had come out at that point. The first time I read it, I was confused, not about who was there, but I was confused as to when she saw him. She was like, you know, she had joy and then happiness, whatever. But as soon as she, like, her face was full of horror and then she screamed, that threw me for a loop. And obviously, once I thought about it, I understood what it might be. But when you first read that, like, how do those two things go together? Well, she did a lot, and she described, we know what it is, but we hear even more later on in the chapter. She did so much to plan this, the timing, the place, everything, and to make it so that Roger would not follow her. So it's all of this, like, oh my gosh, like, I've gotten here. I've succeeded in that. I'm, like, this close to offending my parents. That's all good. But now it hits her like a virtual ton of bricks. She's like, for all she knows, she's now stuck. She has no one else on the other side. So
that's not true. Couldn't she use Joe?
She absolutely could. But I don't think she's thinking of Joe, because I'm sure she has love for Joe, like, a, you know, good, nice family feelings for Joe, like, because I think she calls him Uncle Joe. But he's definitely not an anchor like Roger would have been. But I think that's a good example. Yeah, I think it's possible.
So I think she's overreacting. That's what I'm saying.
I think it's a combination of shock that he's there.
Clearly shock. No, it's totally shock.
But then it goes from shock. Oh my gosh, you're here. Yay, I'm so happy. And then WTF. What have you done? Kind of like, do you remember, whenever I hear someone say these words, I always go back to this line from this movie. Tell me if you recognize this. What have you done? What have you done?
I mean, it sounds familiar, but I don't know.
Okay. No, I don't expect anyone else to get that unless you're a dork like me.
Oh, I know what it is. Last Unicorn.
Exactly. Molly Grew, The Last Unicorn, when she, the whole thing, but she likes the unicorn, blah, blah, blah. She's like probably a middle-aged woman who sees this unicorn, and the magician Schmendrick to save the unicorn from the Red Bull, who is, you know, collects them all for the King Haggard and runs them into the sea and she's the last one left. So the king's like, I gotta have my last one. So the Red Bull senses her and starts chasing her and is going to chase her into the sea, and the last unicorn will be no more. But Schmendrick is a magician and he can change her. He's limited, he thinks, but he's more skilled than he believes. And so he changes her into a human. And as soon as she goes from a mortal creature to immortal creature to a mortal creature, this human, which is a Lady Amalthea, they call her, is a, she says she feels, I feel this body begin to die. So as soon as she changes forms, she's no longer immortal. So anyway, she's saying this and she's like, she can't walk and she's naked. They have to cover her up and all these things. And Molly Grew, who is someone who has, at least in fantasy, in story, in lore, has heard of the legends of the unicorn. And growing up, always
you know, always wondered why, you know, hoped she'd see one, hoped she'd be visited by one, hoped she'd be able to be with one or be near one. And here she sees one. And when she sees it, it turns into a human. And then she hears her say, "I feel this body dying all around me." Molly Grew says to Schmendrick the magician, "What have you done? What have you done?" And so that is not related to Outlander.
No. Well, unicorns are the national animal of Scotland.
Oh, well then, hey, see, okay, Summer, you just slipped that in there. So anytime I can mention, I have free reign now of Last Unicorn people. Woohoo!
I take it back. I changed it last year. It's now a dragonfly.
Oh, Lord, Summer, that's awesome. No, you can't. But she is right. It is. So there's a new bra that I have found in a very interesting way. I really do like it. It is from a company called Third Love. And Third Love is known for a few things. One of them is that they say that they will find you the perfect fit. Using thousands of real women's measurements, Third Love designs its bras with breast size and shape in mind so that they fit impeccably and even feel better.
And they have the most sizes of any brands. Third Love just added 24 new sizes, making them the industry leader with a total of 70 sizes.
So as I said, I found it in my bra in an interesting way, and that was using their Fit Finder quiz. You answer a few simple questions to find your perfect fit. It's actually kind of fun and takes less than a minute. And did you know that breast shape matters when finding a good fit? Third Love helps you identify your breast size and shape and find styles that fit your body.
So hands down, they have the most comfortable bras you will ever own. They're tagless labels, so no itching, the straps won't slip, and ultra soft smoothing fabrics. They are lightweight, super thin memory foam cups. And once you put it on, you're going to forget you have it on, which as most bra wearers know, is not generally always the case.
Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now they're offering our listeners 15% off of your first order.
So go to thirdlove.com/outlander now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase.
That's thirdlove.com/outlander for 15% off today. But anyway, the reason I bring that up is because that's the phrase that I, or the phrasing, like the tone of voice, that kind of thing. I actually imagined the movie clip, but that's just because I've never seen a lot of memes from the movie. But anyway, the look on Bree's face and how she reacts to him, I think of, "What have you done? What have you done?" That's what I first, I was like, "Oh my God."
I kind of feel that it would be like the equivalent of being out on the town or whatever and looking around in the bar and seeing someone that you know and being like, "Hey, fancy meeting you here." And then realizing that you were paying them to babysit your kids. Who's watching my kids? That's like funny. That moment of, wait, why are you here and who's watching the kids?
I mean, I guess I do get what you're saying. Absolutely. That's horrific. But
you're not where you're supposed to be.
At the bottom, the bottom line is you're not where you're supposed to be. You're not supposed to be here. Whatever the reason, you're not supposed to be here. I'm happy to see you, kind of, but yeah. So she goes outside and Roger follows her and he takes her down the road to the shelter of a big horse chestnut tree. They demand of each other what they're doing there. He says it's all right. He'll take care of her now. But she has another angle. Quote, "How can you say that?" Again, "What have you done? What have you done? For God's sakes, you're here." She is horrified. She feels lost. Because she doesn't know something that Roger has found out, and we'll come back to that. Lorraine B. writes, "As we see Roger follow Brianna's trail and experience his mounting anger over her," not mounting angrily over her, but he will do that too. Ha ha ha. I'm just kidding. "Over her unwitting flaunting of her sexuality." Of course, that's her wearing the breeches. "For me, the rage and violence that follows between these two was still shocking. Diana totally captures all the fear, anger, and relief of both of them feel. I found it funny but sweet that Roger thinks everything will be okay because he's there and he'll take care of Bree. I wonder if women were more independent in America than in Britain in the late 60s, or is it just that he's a little old-fashioned? Surely he must figure that she's managed well enough on her own this far." What do you think about that?
All I know
is
that
you have an opinion of him coming in and saying, I am here now. I can save you.
I was so over that. Like, that bothered me on a visceral level in a way that I don't think it's bothered me in the past. And I don't know if it's because I'm older and I do all these things for myself, or, you know, if it's a little bit of like the whole feminist movement of, you know, hey, we're people too, and we can do all the same things you can do. We just don't have penises, or any number of things. It could also be maybe because of the whole Me Too movement, or just any of the things. But him coming in like an unwanted knight in shining armor really rubbed me wrong.
So Roger goes after her and she slaps him. He's horrified that she's parading around in breeches, and he kisses her. She resists, but then kisses him back. Okay, let's start right there.
That guy.
That is like a total 50s, 40s, maybe even 30s, I don't know, but like 40s, 50s, 60s movie thing. Maybe 70s. I don't know. I don't watch every single movie that's ever made. But that is so trope, isn't it?
It's very like formula, for sure.
You fight. The woman tries to resist. Not that she doesn't like you or hates you or anything like that, but she's like trying to actually have a conversation, or you're arguing about something. And you think that just even, and you know she likes you. That's an advantage that you, knowledge that you do have. But you think that if you just pull her to you and kiss her and shut her up by kissing her, that she'll, you know, in if not right away, in a few moments, succumb to you because you're a man and you're taking care of whatever reasons fill your brain, that she'll succumb to you. And thus, maybe you don't win the fight, but you shut her up. And then you just like, she's a puddle in your arm. You know what I'm saying? I that was a bit much for me.
I believe that I can like a person and still maintain the autonomy of making a decision whether or not I want to be kissed by somebody. And just because I'm becoming way less
tolerant
to stuff like this, because it's like the people who are like, oh, well, he's your husband, you should just have sex with him because he wants to have sex with you. Because he's your husband and that's what you do. Well, that's not.
I don't know a lot of people like that.
No, it's, I'm not saying you do, but there, you know, that was the whole mentality for years and years and years. And probably also for the era that this took place in, that it was, you know, you thought you'd do the dutiful wife thing and you do the things you're supposed to do. But I definitely don't prescribe to that. And, you know, A, if I want to have a conversation, we should have a conversation. You know, it's like, kissing me to shut me up, honestly, that's not going to end the conversation. I really dislike the whole, I'm going to forcibly kiss you, you're going to struggle, and then you're going to relent. I hate that.
Yeah, I know. Me too. I don't think I'm less tolerant of that, although that may be the end effect. I think I'm more sensitive to it now. Whereas before, like in romance novels, you know, I read historical, Harlequin historicals in early high school, and I read The Flowers in the Attic. My goodness, at age 11, that's in there. People, I mean, there's a lot more in there, but you know what I mean? There's, when you grow up with that in literature and on television, it's not shocking, right? Because that's what supported. It's displayed and no one talks against it because it's romantic. Well, I will admit that I see it a lot less these days. Typically, if I see it, I still see it. But it might be in like historical films or something and not, you know, modern day fare, whatever. But it's not that I definitely don't love it, but it's not that I am less tolerant, although I think in the end it makes me less tolerant of those things. But I'm definitely more sensitive, whereas before I would see it and not really think about it. Or heck, when I was really young, I might say, oh, he's so romantic. You know what I'm saying?
Or he really likes her.
When I see it, I go like, "What? Like we just said, this read through, I was like, oh no, I've never had this reaction to Rogers in this chapter before. So it's definitely a change of our time and me getting older, us becoming more, you know, I don't want to say wise. Hopefully we're getting wiser, but that's not what I'm claiming. Just that we're, I think as you mature and as society, your culture hopefully shifts. Yeah, but I'm with you. I didn't have a difficult time reading it because, you know, it's a beautiful chapter. But I was surprised at what I didn't remember. And by that, it means it didn't affect me so much. You know what I mean? So I'm more sensitive to it now, which is what I'm trying to say. So it definitely rubbed me kind of the wrong way. But I think it's in character. Maybe not, I think it's in character for someone of the 18th century. I don't know. I would expect that more as enlightened as people may say he is or like to say he is. Jamie is still a man of the 18th century, period. I don't care what anyone says. He may be more enlightened. He is not modern. I would not expect that of Roger. I would expect it of Jamie.
I'm wondering if the time period where he is now is rubbing off on him. Because he straight up kissed that stranger lady in the hold. It smelled like poop and sour milk.
Poop and urine and everything, yeah. Yeah, but he didn't like tongue French or anything. He just like smacked her on the lips gently. Or tenderly. But yeah, absolutely. So forget Morag. Forget Horag. I think the answer has to be yes. Because he's had, you know, a difficult time of it. He went through what he went through on the ship. He, you know, had all the labor. He's been thinking about Bree this whole time and seeing families and seeing, you know, families in very difficult situations, namely those in the, you know, in the steerage. Just from what he's seen, I understand his drive to find her for her protection. I get it. I even wasn't so shocked or upset. I was not shocked at all. And I really honestly wasn't upset, like I have a right to be upset, about him saying, I'm here now, I'll take care of you. Because that, I can get in 18th century now. I can get along with that. You know what I mean? I understand what he's saying.
Not even just 18th century, because that's also indicative of the 60s. Yes, they were starting to move towards a freer existence for women. Like, you know, the whole movement, like the free love and all of those movements that were happening in the 60s. They were still just coming out of, you know, the subjugation of women.
Yeah, but I think especially in the 18th century and especially given that he's been in the 18th century for at least 2 months or so, that's not an incredibly long time. It's like, but it's long enough to become acclimatized to certain things, like later on in the chapter when we hear, I think Diana's describing that just his time that he's spent in the 18th century and been around women in dresses, him seeing Brianna, I'm sure he had seen her. He's seen her in pants in the 60s. It doesn't bug him one iota. Actually, not even just pants. He hasn't seen a woman with her legs defined. The fact that she even has two legs. Because when you're wearing a skirt, you're like a blob. You're like one piece on the bottom. I can understand his thing like, you know, I'm here. Because he's worried about her. So all he's thinking is, you know, I'm scared for her being alone. He has no idea about Lizzie. He has no idea about her family, whatever. And I think he has every right to be. And I'm happy he's protective. That's fine. Like I said, I wasn't upset or shocked that he's like, I mean, I was a little bit like, but I wasn't pissed and I wasn't shocked that he would like sweep in and say, I am here now. I will take care of you. You're safe. Okay. It might be a bit much, but 18th century, I get it. Okay. That's not shocking. What got me was the, I'm going to shut you up with a kiss. That was like, that's not cool, Roger. So to continue or finish this bit, he kisses her and she resists, but then she kisses him back, as they always do in the romance novels, because doesn't she always relent?
Yep.
And then she's crying and sobbing. This just doesn't make sense to him or to the reader, perhaps. You're like, why is she crying? We understand her being shocked. We understand her being happy. We may not understand, especially if it's your first read, may not understand her being pissed off. But now she's like freaking out. And the scream, what the heck? She's freaking out. You're like, woman, whoa, no one's hurt. What's going on?
Well, maybe if he hadn't kissed her into silence, she would have told him a lot sooner.
I know, and told us. So this just doesn't make sense to him or to the reader, perhaps. But she needed him back there, back in the 20th century, to be her anchor so she could return. Quote, you're the only person I love at that end. He stopped dead, fear and anger both forgotten. Then they basically start to wrestle. When they calm down, he demands to hear the words. She tells him she loves him, and then quote, what are we going to do?
We live here now. Duh.
Roger lay in the dust of the road, bruised, filthy, and starving, with the woman trembling and weeping against his chest, now and then giving him a small thump with her fist. He had never felt happier in his life. Unquote. So he calms her and says, there's another way. Now this he would have learned from the grimoire. She finally says that while she didn't want him following her, she's very happy he's there. He finds out that she'd been planning her trip about six months. She had dreamt about both of her fathers. Quote, one dream in particular. It had been night in the dream, somewhere tropical, with fields of tall green plants that might have been sugarcane and fires burning in the distance. There were drums beating, and I knew something was hiding, waiting in the canes. Something horrible. My mother was there, drinking tea with the crocodile. Then he stepped out of the canes. Unquote. She couldn't see his face because it was dark, but she could see that he had red hair, standing between her mother and the awful thing. Quote, then I knew my mother was going to stand up and rock white and walk right toward it. I tried to stop her, but I couldn't make her hear me or see me. So I turned to him and I called to him to go with her, to save her from whatever it was. And he saw me. He did. He saw me and he heard me. And then I woke up. Unquote. So, sound familiar, anyone? Now, I don't get the chill bumps anymore, but I'm sure the first time I read the book, I was like, what? What was your reaction, Sam?
No, I didn't have chill bumps. I mean, I think that was my assumed thought after the thing happened.
She says it made her think that if Roger couldn't find them in Scotland after 1766 or on any emigration rolls in the colonies, but she'd seen them in the tropics. What if they were in the Indies? Roger hadn't found them on ships' rolls. She says, what if they weren't passengers? So she had traveled to Jamaica looking for them, and she found them. Quote, a Captain James Fraser of a ship named Artemis sold 5 tons of bat guano to a planter in Montego Bay on April 2nd, 1767. Unquote. And
I knew that bat guano was going to get them into trouble.
Okay, so I have two things that come to my mind, and they're both songs. I think we did it when we were in Voyager 2. I think we did that 5 tons of bat guano. That's what they get, the 5 tons of guano, 5 tons of guano. Didn't we?
I don't remember doing that, no. I remember that song, but I don't remember it being about guano.
It wasn't. Okay, and the other one is whenever I see Kokomo or Montego, I think of that song. Oh my goodness. And I think we all know what I mean. Christina O writes, Brianna tells Roger she started having dreams about 6 months earlier, when she was still in 1971, about her mother and Jamie. They were actually more like visions, but they seemed like dreams to her since they were fragmented and confusing. When she talks about one particular dream to Roger, it's exciting for readers because we know she had a vision that crossed centuries of time. She described a tropical night in a sugarcane field with distant fires, drums beating, and her mother drinking tea with a crocodile. Easy to see why she thought she was dreaming. At the same time, over about 200-year time warp, Margaret Campbell, who was sitting next to Claire on a bench surrounded by Jamaican sugarcane fields, turned her head to look sharply at Jamie, who was standing nearby. Daddy, she said with great certainty, I knew it was you. I've been dreaming about you. And then, don't let Mama go alone. You go with her. I'll keep you safe. Jamie and Claire were completely gobsmacked. Of course, she's referring to that scene, the voodoo scene on Jamaica in Voyager. So interesting that Margaret channels Brianna as yet unborn from 200 years in the future. And that it's Jamie, not Claire, who connects her with her message. Now, actually, Brianna was born.
because Brianna, first and foremost, is of Claire's timeline, right? Because she was of Claire's womb. Brianna was conceived in the 18th century, born in the 20th century, and then Claire goes back. So she's absolutely born because Claire's already given birth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we've already established that it kind of runs concurrently.
Yeah. I'm just saying it's not, she's not yet unborn. She's already born. And just to solidify it, quote, on April the 1st, a woman named Claire Fraser bought a slave from the slave market in Kingston, unquote.
As you do.
Shazam. She couldn't find anything more about the slave, Temeraire, but she did find a death notice. Their death notice. And of course, that would be the fire. But, she said, we have time to warn them. He tells her that he thought she'd found someone else. He says he thought that the tone of her letters to him had changed. He tells her he'd found out from her boxes arriving at college that she'd gone away. They play tousled, and he mentioned wife beating in jest, mostly in jest. And she brings up the word wife. He says, you said you were sure. Do you mean it? And she says, yes. Then they start to get frisky. Now, before we go forward into frisky, what's just happened? What's the, besides the word yes, what's the last thing that they just discuss before they get frisky? She says, I found them. I couldn't find anything more about the slave, but I found their death notice. But it's okay because there's time to warn them. That's where she stopped. And then they get frisky. So remember where they stopped, because this is a problem.
Now, I would like to say that over the years, as we discuss potential things that come to pass and will come to pass in the series that they are filming, we have a really good track record of saying they have to leave this in, and then they cut it. I feel really confident that they're totally going to leave this scene in.
Oh, the fighting?
No, the screwing.
So where they stopped off before they got frisky was her saying, I found the death notice, but there's still time to save them. It's all good. Then they get frisky. So people are coming out of the tavern, and these lovebirds, they need some privacy. There's no better place than your nearest shed. So they go to the shed, and it's dark. And basically, they next get to basically a hand fasting. Quote, in the isles and the remoter parts of the highlands, where folk were a long way from the nearest minister, a man and woman now would be handfast, vowed to each other for a year and a day. At the end of it, they find a minister and wed more permanently, or they go their own ways, unquote. So they give their vows. I, Roger Jeremiah, do take thee, Brianna Ellen, to be my lawful wedded wife. With my goods I endow thee, with my body I thee worship, unquote. Diana slips in a, quote, her hand twitched in his and his balls tightened, unquote. Diana, continuing. In sickness and in health, in richness and in poverty, so long as we both shall live. And then Bree does the same. Quote, the phrase meant a good bit more to each of them now, he thought, than it would have even a few months before. The passage through the stones was enough to impress anyone with the fragility of life. Unquote. And then, quote, he raised her hand to his mouth and kissed it on the knuckle of her fourth finger where one day, God willing, her ring would be. Unquote. So they're in this shed and there's an animal at the other end, but no worries. It was very dark. Quote, undressing her was both frustration and delight. So he loves her backside, and we learn that she, a name that either she gave her, probably she didn't give herself, but she got the name of Jugbutt. So she's making fun of herself. That name comes up a few times. After his trousers fall, they kiss, and Diana, in one of her famous methods of setting a scene, tells us that Brianna had eaten onions with her dinner because he tasted them. Exactly. Now that's worth.
He tasted them 18 times.
Should this episode be called 18 times with absolutely no reference? And so Brianna has a grip on him and she kneels in front of him
Wowza. And then she says, am I doing it right? Quote, he approached his own duty with mingled excitement and caution. He had tried this exactly once, only to be met with a face full of feminine hygiene product that smelled like the flowers in his father's church on Sunday. Unquote. Brianna was not hygienic. What an awful thing to write. I think that line gave me the most, like, oh, in the whole chapter.
Well, I mean, seriously, though, what option does she have?
She doesn't.
Exactly. So why mention it?
That's what I mean.
Because she needs to have a taste and smell.
Oh,
for all of the senses.
I don't need you to add that some. He half jokingly asks her if he's doing it right. And she says, oh, yeah, you sure are. And then he stops and demands, just how the hell do you know that? Oh, Lord. This is so funny. And then when they're just about to do it, just about, she asks him, Roger, are you really big? I mean, it is dark, so I understand the girl has a concern. And then afterwards, or just before the afterwards, we get the answer later. It's not 100% graphic, and I thank you for that, Diana, but it is really clearly implied. But at first, it doesn't say he did this or this happened. Like, it wasn't outlined in detail, for which I am grateful, but that meant that I had to kind of connect a few dots. So I first wrote, wait, did he pull out? Here's the line, quote, he ought to stop shaking and gasping. He jerked free of her body and lay on her as he jerked and moaned, unquote.
Yeah, he totally pulled out.
That's what I thought. I was just like, wait, outside, so he pulled out of something. Martina P. writes, the detailed description of Brianna and Roger's sexual encounter is combined with typical Diana Gabaldon humor. I don't know of any author that combines these two items as well as she does. I was actually doing my peak challenge exercises while listening to this chapter and had to drop the barbell to the ground because I had to chuckle and wasn't able to lift it any longer. It is just priceless when Roger explains that he had not washed or bathed in days. Afterwards, continued, Brianna asks him if she was okay. Quote, the book didn't say anything about that, but then it wouldn't. It didn't bother with what happens afterwards, unquote. So he's shocked that she learned things in a book. They go again, and then three times a lady. In the end, he says he's sorry they didn't wait. He's thinking like, oh, you deserve like a bed and sheets and a fancy bed, da, da, da. And she's like, nah, it was good. She's happy. She says, even if they don't get back, she doesn't think she's ever been so happy. He reminds her that he'd said there was another way. He tells her about the grimoire of the witch, Galus. How the second time he thought of her, Brianna. They think it might be a way to steer. He recites a poem or something that is kind of akin to a poem from the book about gems. Now, he thinks part of it is traditional ritual and then other parts of it is definitely witchcraft. And then we get to a fairly serious chat about Gabaldonian TT, the introduction of ley lines to the theory. Quote, every now and again, the lines run close to each other and sort of curl up into knots. And wherever you get such a knot, you've got a place where time essentially doesn't exist, unquote. But then there's the problem of getting gemstones. So you have talk about steering, talk about gemstones, and then talk about maybe the reason why these vortexes or these time places between times where there's no time, whatever, wherever the stones are marked, whatever the stones are markers of that thing where these ley lines come into knots, there's that conversation is worth that. There's discussion of that. So they agree they probably need a gem each to get back. And the problem is getting them. They have no money that they would need. And even if they had it right where they're at, there's like no one dealing with that kind of stuff that they could guess. He says he thinks he knows where he could get one stone, but he'd have to leave it once to get it from a man in New Bern. She says she's found her father.
she lets Roger know that she'd found Jamie. She says she can't wait for him, cannot wait for Roger to come back because of Lizzie. She needs to get Lizzie to her mom. So the plan is that he'll go to New Bern and come back to join her as soon as he can. He admits that he will steal the stone. She's very concerned because this is definitely no joke. She doesn't want him to, as they hang people for stealing. And then they do it again. Afterwards, the pillow talk. Quote, do you know, I think I've just married my great aunt 6 times removed.
Worst pillow talk ever.
Don't worry. It's nowhere close enough to be incest. Well, that's good. So that means he's not only related to Bree, but also to Jamie. So all this talk, if I had it on paper, I could probably make sense of it so I could see it like visually. But it's so odd, the things that might confuse some, not confuse, but the things that once you start getting about removed and left and generations back, at years back, etc., certain things are harder for me to conceive of or follow, at least, than others. For example, the whole thing about that family tree, I'm like, I need to see that on paper to be able to like visualize it. Yet we can talk about TT and people like doubling and tripling back on their timelines, and I'm like, I'm good. So it's really weird what what I can easily conceptualize or not. But I found that interesting. So genealogy gets me a little bit confused, or at least what was described here, but not TT typically. Then some more stuff gets let out. Roger says he never went to Lallybroch. And she wants to know how he found her. And then she knows. And he knew she knew. And she's furious. And of course, by that, I mean, if he did not go to Lallybroch, how would he even think of where or why or how she was going somewhere? And where? The only thing that makes sense is that he found the article, the notice, the death notice as well. And he never shared it with her. So that's the big thing. Is he, I guess, a lie by omission. He didn't share something that was so, so, so brutal. He defends himself, and she's not buying that they couldn't change things. He reminds her of Culloden and how her parents had tried but failed to change it. She's still not having it. Quote, it's not your business to make up my mind for me, no matter what you thought. Unquote. He had robbed her of her agency. Okay, so let's go back a little bit. There's a few examples of that. Maybe not as strong as this example, but a few. It just goes back to our discussion thus far in the chapter some about things that have surprised us about his behavior or his things like, I'm here now, all is safe, you are safe. And then his trying to win an argument or trying to shut her up by kissing her. You know what I'm saying? The things that we've discussed thus far. And then there's this. He truly did think he was saving her from sadness, saving her from knowledge, and saving her definitely from a trip, you know, a dangerous trip back in time by keeping it from her. Not necessarily thinking that she would, you know, maybe come across it on her own. And of course, that's exactly what happened. So that line is very, very strong to me. It is not your business to make up my mind for me, no matter what you thought. So just because you're doing it, even out of the best intention, it is not your right to make someone's mind up for them if they have, you know, full mind capability, full mind and are cognizant. She's incredulous that he's blaming her for being there. She'd done everything she could to think of preventing him from coming after her. She shoves him to the ground, gets dressed, and leaves. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, she goes back to their lodgings with Lizzie. Bree is furious and she's taking it out on the door. She's throwing her shoes and throwing her clothes. I mean, she's just like ranting, a physical rant. Lizzie, in bed, is surprised at her mistress's acting out. Quote, from the black air beyond the window, a voice roared, Brianna, I shall come for you. Do you hear me? I will come. Unquote.
Seriously. Menacing.
That reminded me of a movie.
Yeah, Last of the Mohicans. No yes. matter what, because I will find you.
Yes. Da, 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 da,
da, da, da, da. It's like anything else in life. Take out the good-looking male lead.
Oh, my goodness.
Put in literally anyone else in that situation. Put someone that you don't find attractive in that situation and have them doing that. Is it still sexy? Ooh, do you still enjoy it? No, you find it creepy and you call the cops.
I mean, I feel like this chapter's become the new Geneva for me.
That's funny. It's funny. Definitely. Yeah, right? I never had those feelings. I always had odd feelings about the Geneva chapter. Always. But this one, I don't think I did until this conversation. Bree undresses and leaves her clothing on the floor. In bed, she is shaking. Finally, she gets to sleep, but Lizzie can't sleep. She gets up and collects the clothing from the floor, and then she gets a little bit nosy. But like I said, she's not really nosy. It's her job. She's been doing this, except for when she's ill. That's why I said this in the first part of the chapter and put a little emphasis on it, that she was feeling better so well that she did their laundry. Well, that shows you that that is her habit. That is one of her duties as her bondservant. Chores, duties, whatever. So she picks up the clothing from the floor. Again, this is her job. And she sees how dirty they are. But she's seeing, you know, that it's like mud and or dirt and straw, whatever. But she smells them. And she recognizes the smell of a man. Like a rutting man. I know, that's kind of gross.
It's like the cum trees.
Oh, my God. Oh, the ones we have here?
Uh-huh. Oh, they're Lord. Ornamental yeah. pears. They smell like semen. Lord.
So as she scrubs the clothing, she finds the blood in the crotch of the breeches. And that's the end of the chapter, except that we have more commentary. Christine O writes, just briefly, there are two incidents of walking away in this chapter that really surprised me and seemed a bit strange. First, when Brianna left Lizzie alone in the room with an 18th century apothecary. How is that going to have a good outcome?
My opinion on that is that, I mean, I get what she's saying, but that's what you did in like the 60s.
Oh, that's true.
You went and saw your doctor and, you know, you gave them uh-huh. privacy. And I mean, Lizzie's not her daughter. She's, you know, it's like your friend and you're going to be like, dude, I'm going to give you some privacy with a doctor. The doctor's going to take care of you. You putting your trust in that medical professional. So, I mean, that didn't bother me, that particular part.
Second, when Roger, after finally meeting up with Brianna and having the most funny, awkward, wonderful, sexy reunion, leaves her to go steal gems. Come on, there are so many reasons why he should never have let her walk away alone. You know there are going to be major consequences. That's putting it mildly.
I mean, it's Diana Gabaldon and we're not done with the book yet. So everything that's done by everyone this early in the book has consequences.
Lorraine B. writes, before Outlander, I'd read very few books with sex in them. I think the best one was Clan of the K-Bear, and I always felt a little uncomfortable. Diana has a way of writing love scenes that have a truth to them that doesn't make me uncomfortable. Brianna and Roger's first time is truly joyful until all hell breaks loose. How unfortunate that Bree finds out that Roger knew about the notice in the newspaper. For this ignites yet another violent outburst that causes no end of trouble.
Ginger, did you ever read Clan of the Cave Bear?
I read certain parts.
I read the first book and it was pretty rapey.
I read certain parts.
So you read the rapey parts?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's what I thought. My point is I don't consider rapey scenes.
That's not love scene. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, those aren't remotely in the same category, in my opinion. But I get what she says.
And I would feel uncomfortable reading those too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And finally, Martina P. writes, I do enjoy their little quiet pillow talk before the storm breaks loose. I love how Brianna describes her dream sequence when she was in the West Indies. It is exactly like the scene we saw in Voyager. Dreams always have a powerful meaning throughout Diana's books. It is quite mysterious. Brianna also has every right to be upset with Roger about withholding such important information about her parents from her. However, I do think she's a little over the top. Is she not? At times, I just can't understand Brianna's behavior. The relationship just doesn't have the magic that Jamie and Claire's does, and I find myself not as invested just yet. Now, Martina, I think it's just as sparks, like sparky, as far as like, you know, the fighting and everything. I think they have that in common with Jamie and Claire, but no, I mean, it took a good book more. I honestly don't think I, as a reader, this is Ginger, I don't think I, as a reader, really, I never hated Bree like a lot of people did, but I don't think I appreciated Bree really until, I won't say what happens, but until like, I think book 7.
I'm 8 books in and I still don't like Bree.
Book 8, again, no spoilers, Bree's a freaking badass. She's B.A. Book 8, she's B.A. She is completely Jamie and Frank's daughter, completely in book 8. She's B.A. But I'm not going to say what that means. Just B.A. Read it. But I really, really, really appreciate her. I love her in 8. I really appreciate her in 7. 6, I don't hate her. She never grew on me. Their relationship didn't grow on me until 7 and 8, I don't think. Now, I found it funny, not surprising. I understand why this happened, but I found it funny how everyone honed in on the sex. I mean, you would expect them to, right?
I mean, there was a lot of it.
There was. It was their first time. It was very special. It was very unique. It was funny, touching.
Look at the title of the chapter.
Absolutely.
Even Diana was focused on the sex.
Absolutely. But then, I would say 2 points, mostly the sex. Secondarily, the fact that Brianna had found Jamie and Claire. That I get, right? Because that's also big. So you have a lot of big things in this chapter. I'm not surprised it wasn't number one. And I'm not surprised it wasn't number two. But I'm surprised that no listener who sent in their comments even mentioned TT at all. Because this is something... Now, earlier, before Roger goes back, when he's there and Fiona gives him the grimoire, and he's going through it. So we've had this discussion. You and I have already talked about what he finds in the grimoire. And there's talk of, I believe he goes over the talk of ley lines. So it's not that it's never come up in our discussion or in our show, but as far as two time travelers actually talking about TT, right? About the theory. This is, except for what was included when he was going through the grimoire, it is absolutely, I think, as of this conversation, and then later on in this book, as of this book, we have not everything, but I think we... By the end of this book, we have bulk of what constitutes the Gabaldonian theory of time travel, as far as what we know. I mean, different things. There are bulges that mention different things. But as far as the thinking of a person, the dates, the ley lines, and the gems and steering, I think by the end, actually by now, but definitely by the end of book 4, I don't think, or I should say after book 4, we're not adding yet a lot of new stuff. Because even in Voyager, when there was another portal that, of course, Brianna and Roger don't know about because they weren't back there, in Voyager, we learned that, oh my gosh, Scotland, Craig Nadan was not the only spot. That was huge and mind-blowing. So we learn more each book, but I don't know that we have any more mind-blowing things after book 4 or after book 4 things come on. We've already met, so we know that Claire, Brianna, Roger, and Galus are travelers, right? Well, if there's those 4, I mean, it's not just Claire. As soon as it was more than just Claire, that's a huge beacon in the sky that, or, you know, like ding, 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 that she may, if she's not the only one, they're not only 2. You know what I mean? So I think it's just so exciting to find out who may be another traveler. So always keep that in the back of your mind, back of your mind. You never know. But yeah, I was kind of surprised that no one mentioned the TT. They're all about the sex. I'm like, I get it. But this is a TT book, but it's also a sex book. Okay.
That was chapter 40. Join us next week when we discuss chapter 41 entitled Journey's End. And as always, join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Find us at outlanderpod.com/group.
If you love our show and are entertained by it, please consider supporting us on Patreon. There are also a number of free ways to help support our show. The most important way you can support us is to help spread the word. Tell your friends and family about our show. And of course, there is still room on our Pod Abroad 2019. To find out more about the trip and the itinerary and the dates and the schedule and all the details, go to podabroad.com and watch on our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We will be doing live Q&As. We'll give you notice so you know when they're coming. We'll be doing Q&As to answer questions about the upcoming trip and the past as well. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com.
find us on Facebook, facebook.com/OutlanderPod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.